is the UR Business Network.
Welcome to the Medical Travel Show on the UR Business Network, the forum for ideas, challenges, and benefits for participants in the international medical travel sector. This is Irving Stackpole, and I'm here today with my co-host, Elizabeth Ziemba.
Hello, Irving, and I'm delighted to be welcoming our guest this afternoon, Glenn Cohen, who is a professor at Harvard Law School. Professor Cohen is one of the world's leading experts on the intersection of medical ethics, the law, and health law. Professor Cohen has spoken at legal, medical, and industry conferences around the world. His work has appeared in or been covered on PBS, NPR, ABC, CNN, MSNBC, Mother Jones, The New York Times, The New Republic, The Boston Globe, and now The Medical Travel Show. He is He's the author of the recent book, Patients with Passports, which explores the legal and ethical issues of international health travel. Welcome to the show, Professor Cohen.
Thank you very much for having me.
So with a resume like that, Glenn, the question that pops to mind first is, how did you get involved in international health travel?
You know, so I myself are in some ways an international health traveler. I'm originally from Canada. My mother had a hip replacement. She wanted to avoid a queue in Canada, so she had it done in the United States, and we spent some time kind of looking into this. So that was kind of one of the first things that got me interested in this. And then just in general, I found the subject fascinating. And there wasn't a lot of writing on the law and ethics when I started writing about this. And I just thought it was really fertile ground to mix together some medical ethics, some law, some economics. And this has been wonderful. It's a great community of people, and I've really enjoyed meeting people in all sectors of it.
With all of these outlets having, you've had been interviewed on MSNBC, Mother Jones, The New York Times, et cetera, what are the topics that seem to be of greatest interest in the public about international medical travel?
Yeah, so I really divide the industry by two bisections. The first is between what I call the legal side and then medical tourism for things that are illegal in the patient's home country, but legal where they're going. And both have been a substantial interest, I would say, to public audiences. On the legal side, people are very interested these days on insurance-prompted medical tourism or insurance-supported, where your insurer in the U.S. gives you a check or waives a deductible to encourage you to use medical travel. And people have also been very interested, I think, on liability questions and quality questions for patients who travel abroad. On the less legal side, the unavailable side, I get lots of press inquiries about travel for reproductive technology, in particular surrogacy tourism and some of the immigration issues when you try to bring a child conceived through a surrogate abroad back to your home country. And I get a lot of inquiries very recently about travel for assisted suicide to Switzerland. And then the third area I think where I get the most media inquiries is actually travel for experimental therapies, in particular stem cell therapies, and parents who are taking their children for stem cell therapies, which raise the host of very interesting questions about best interests of children, the state's role in protecting kids, and stuff like that.
That's just a terrific list of questions and issues to tackle. Are you finding that most of the inquiries are coming from people in the U.S., or are you getting inquiries from people around the world?
It's a mix. In this book, I rolled up my sleeves. So, you know, I know the U.S. situation quite well. I also know the Canadian situation quite well because I do some work with health geographers who study it qualitatively, Canadians going abroad. But I kind of rolled up my sleeves to teach myself more about the inter-EU system. So there's a whole chapter of the new book directed to the new EU directive on cross-border healthcare and the complicated rules about reimbursement by member states to other member states. And also within the EU, there's actually a lot of medical travel for reproductive technologies in particular, because there's a real differential in terms of the ways the various EU member states provide or forbid certain kinds of reproductive technologies. So I taught myself quite a lot about that. But yeah, most of the media attention has been from U.S. audiences, I would say, who are very interested in this topic and, you know, thinking about whether this is something they themselves might want to use one day.
What are you seeing happening in the U.S. insurance market? One of the questions that I receive quite often, and I believe Irving does as well, is the issue about insurance portability.
Right.
Many of the overseas providers have all sorts of misconceptions about how they can tackle the U.S. market and provide opportunities for insurance portability. So what kinds of questions and issues are you hearing, and how can you dispel some of the misconceptions that are out there in the sector?
Yeah, so let me start by saying that we should divide the public insurance from the private insurance world. So in the public insurance, unlike in the European Union, for example, where there's a huge amount of portability under very complicated rules, in the U.S., for the most part, Medicaid, Medicare, other kinds of state-supported benefits are not portable. And there have been some discussions about how much cost savings there would be if we were able to take your Medicare with you to Mexico, for example. There's a lot of medical retirement in Mexico. But for the most part, this has been quite a third rail, and I don't see many changes happening. There is one exception that's kind of interesting, and I read about this in the book, is that actually one of the military retirement healthcare policies, the TRICARE policy, does allow limited portability of benefits for military veterans of certain kinds who retired in another country. So the U.S. government will actually cover some of your healthcare expenditures there. So that's the public side, where there's not a very much portability. On the private side, it's complicated in the following way. Usually, state by state, there is insurance regulation, and state insurance regulation, it turns out, almost accidentally in many cases. A couple places have addressed it specifically, California and Texas. Texas to prohibit it, California to, in some ways, allow some cross-border travel to Mexico. But other than those two states, most state insurance law is silent on medical tourism, but it indirectly makes medical travel, medical tourism quite difficult with an insurance product because of the various laws that govern health maintenance organizations, HMOs, and preferred provider organizations, PPOs. So these were laws designed for the domestic context, but some of their requirements, like how many doctors you have to have available, how far they can be from where the patient lives, makes medical travel insurance very difficult. But there is the good news for people who want to get in the industry is it turns out that there's a quirk of American insurance law, which is there's this statute, ERISA, which was intended to be a pension law, but it indirectly what we say in the law preempts, that means it nullifies a lot of state insurance law if the employer is what we call self-insured. So if the employer, has a lot of its own risk and is a self-insured employer plan, then all these state laws don't govern. And these days, an increasingly large percentage of the American population, especially for people who work for firms larger than 500 people, are self-insured. So we're seeing the places where we're seeing people who are in private insured using medical tourism, getting incentives or just having coverage tends to be self-insured employers, which are large employers in America, and they have these kinds of options.
Are you finding that these options are indeed appealing and attractive to both the managers of the self-insured plans, the companies or the third-party administrators, as well as the employees themselves?
So I'm seeing a lot of experimentation, and there are definitely be success stories. So one of the news stories I commented on, it was an ABC news story, was about an employer, I think it was in North Carolina, offering, checks for $2,000, essentially, for people getting gastric bypass or lap band. I can't quite remember what the surgery was in Costa Rica. Certainly, there's a subset of employers that are finding this quite lucrative as a cost savings. And as you know, often the insurer, forget about the person paying out of pocket, but even the insurer can save 80%, 70%, 60% of the cost if they deal with a provider in India, Thailand, somewhere else, Mexico, for example. So that's a very attractive proposition. And if you're saving 80% of your cost, it's no skin off your back to give 5% or 10% of that savings back to the employee. And whether employees are willing to do this or not, I mean, you have to remember a large percentage, more than majority, I believe, of U.S. citizens don't have passports, right? So they've never traveled abroad. So certainly there's a group of people for whom, if it's covered at home by their private insurer, even if you give them a large incentive, they're not interested in this proposition. But then there's another subset that are interested because they have other financial goals, or because actually, you know, the idea of traveling abroad for care actually itself carries some allure, especially if the procedure is more elective and one for which they don't have safety concerns. So I do think, as you see more experimentation, we'll get a better sense of what is and what is not attractive in this market. And also we'll see more competition among providers abroad who would like to get insurance business, figuring out what is attractive to offer self-insured employers.
This is absolutely fascinating, Glenn, and I think that many of our listeners will agree that there is indeed growing competition among destinations to attract individuals and specifically attract individuals who are insured. From a legal medical malpractice liability perspective, what should an employer who's considering adopting a benefits package that includes foreign medical travel, what should they look at in terms of protecting themselves and protecting their employees?
Yeah, so in terms of protecting employees, so first imagine the person who's suing, who's going out of pocket. They're not prompted by an insurer. They will have a very hard time recovering for medical malpractice if it occurs abroad for a number of reasons. One is it's hard to get these foreign hospitals and foreign providers into U.S. courts. There's often no personal jurisdiction over them. Even if you get them into U.S. courts, your case is often governed by the law of the jurisdiction where the medical error occurred. And if you look at Singapore, Malaysian, Thai, Mexican medical malpractice law, it's all much less remunerative than in the U.S. So your economic incentives to sue are much less.
Right.
Moreover, if you can't bring suit in the U.S. and have to go to India or Thailand or Mexico to bring your lawsuit, particularly in a place like India, the wait for a lawsuit is, you know, many, many years for it to be successful. You have to find foreign doctors willing to testify against their colleagues. So all of this makes it essentially, I think, very hard to win and to bring a lawsuit if you are someone paying out of pocket. For the people who are insurer-prompted, it's a little bit easier in the following respect. It's more likely that the kinds of arrangements between the employer and or the insurer and the foreign hospital will give reasons to bring the foreign providers into U.S. courts for jurisdictional purposes. So that's one positive thing. But many of the other obstacles remain. What I usually tell people from the individual perspective is two things. One is to see whether the hospital that you're doing business with abroad, you're going to see abroad, is willing or has a program by which they'll agree to some kind of non-litigation route, like an arbitration procedure, which can be quicker and easier to implement. The other is to take what I think of as self-help remedies. So there are some insurers. When I first wrote about this, there was one called AOS, there may be others in the market now, who offer an insurance product to cover you for medical malpractice if you travel abroad for medical travel.
Interesting.
And I think so that's not insurance just to cover the follow-up care, but actually to cover medical malpractice. And what's
right.
good about that is it means you get paid through this process and you've bought this insurance ahead of time and you don't have to seek to bring in the foreign provider into U.S. court or to sue them on their home ground. So that's the individual. From the perspective of the employer, my own view here is that employers ought to be quite responsible about this, and they should really seek out foreign hospitals. First of all, ones that are willing to share a lot of their morbidity and mortality data in a way that you can be confident that this is a place of excellence rather than merely an okay place. But then beyond the quality piece, on the liability piece, that you should really be seeking out foreign hospitals that contractually are willing to agree to arbitration or dispute resolution or litigation in the United States should something happen.
Yes.
Now, there may be some liability for the insurer and the employer. I talk a little bit about this in the book. It's speculative. It's hard to know. There may be some legal duties in terms of the selection of a foreign hospital. So in the domestic context, when you, for example, send a patient to a provider that you know has a drug and alcohol problem and has problems before, for example, you can face some kinds of negligent selection liability if you negligently select it. It's unclear what that would look like for an employer using medical travel. It may be, for example, that as long as you pick a foreign provider that has JCI accreditation or, you know, has a good reputation or, you know, meets some standards, that whatever liability you may face will go away. But this is very uncertain because we've really seen no lawsuits like this.
So I think what you're saying is that there is I think what you're saying is that there's quite a bit of uncertainty here, and that employers and the individuals need to proceed very carefully and look for providers in foreign destinations which are willing to sign up to very simple arbitration and or liability requirements. Is there much case law? Have there been cases tried in that you can point to?
So the short answer is no, and that is in some ways interesting for someone who writes about this industry, right? So
yes.
Thinking when I did the last search, I found one single case that looked a little bit like medical tourism, but its facts were very strange. It involved somebody who was like in the custody of the prison system in Canada or in the U.S. who required treatment in the other country for some reason and had medical error. So very unlike the kinds of cases that we deal with in the industry. So the one interesting question is, why are there not more cases? So in the last book I did, called The Globalization of Healthcare, in a chapter by Lee Turner, who is a bioethicist from Minnesota, and he went basically through newspaper reports of people in the Dominican Republic and around there who had died or had negative adverse events from gastric bypass, lap band, other of those kinds of surgeries in the Dominican Republic. And he tried to track down through newspaper reports the stories of these medical tourists who had suffered adverse events. So there are definitely people out there who have suffered adverse events, but they don't seem to be bringing suit. Now, one thing is, it's possible, as I said earlier, your chance of succeeding in a lawsuit is very low, so people aren't bothering. The other possibility, and I suspect this is the truth, but it's just speculation because I don't have access to this, is that the leading foreign hospitals in medical travel, medical tourism, are very sensitive to the kind of bad publicity that a lawsuit would bring, and that many of them are seeking to settle these cases very quickly in such a way that is unlikely to generate an actual lawsuit or adverse publicity. So it's hard to know what the base rate of medical error is, but we do know that there are no reported decisions except for this quirky one I mentioned that I've seen involving people who traveled for medical reasons.
Well, this is just an absolutely fascinating conversation, Glenn, and I am sure that our audience will find it both interesting and no doubt we can have you back if you're willing, and we can dive more deeply into some of these topics. Please tell the audience how they can reach you should they want to get in touch with you.
Yeah, the best way to reach me is either on Twitter, at Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, Prof, P-R-O-F, one word. Or you can send me an email to my Harvard Law School account, IGCOHEN, IG Cohen, at law.harvard.edu.
Well, thank you for being our guest today. I feel like the listeners to the Medical Travel Show have been treated to a Harvard Law School symposium on this issue, which has certainly been incredibly informative and educational. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, this is Irving Stackpole and Elizabeth Ziemba. You have been listening to the Medical Travel Show on the UR Business Network.
You're listening to the UR Business Network.